ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
The axiom in the investor community is never bet against Elon, because even if one has questions about his mental health, the simple message of the numbers in his companies are highly confidence creating.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
American drivers will have one less electric vehicle maker to choose from with the news that EV company Polestar has been banned from selling in the United States. So why is the Swedish brand paying the price for Chinese tech? And what questions does this raise for a booming Australian EV market packed with Chinese cars? Meanwhile, property shows a slight uptick in auction clearance rates, but the market overall continues to cool. What to make of these latest numbers? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor Michael Yander.
And Michael, I found this story really interesting. We've been looking a lot at the take-up of electric vehicles in Australia, which has been supercharged by the global energy crisis, particularly when we saw petrol prices spike soon after the Israeli-American strikes on Iran and the associated war. But another big driver has been the falling prices of EVs, mainly driven by huge amounts and an assortment of Chinese electric vehicles flooding into the Australian market. Now, one of the reasons why Australians have seen this extraordinary take up is because we don't have tariffs, well, very small tariffs, very limited tariffs on electric vehicles coming in. Most places we have free trade with. And so they're cheaper compared to a lot of other places where different countries do have pretty high tariffs on Chinese cars in particular because they have become so cheap. But in America, we have this law in place which basically says to electric car makers that you need to prove that you're not using Chinese tech and you're not using both components and software in your cars. This is not thanks to Donald Trump. This is a Biden-era law that came into effect that says you need to prove to us that the American data is safe from being sent back to China. And this particularly has to do with concerns about all the devices that are now in electric vehicles. I mean, these are just like massive computers on wheels. They've got microphones, they've got cameras, they've got GPS tracking, huge amounts of data. And there is a major concern that that data could be being sent back to China and therefore is a national security risk. Now, Polestar is the first electric vehicle company to be banned under this rule because it wasn't able to assuage concerns in America that it had made sure there wasn't any tech in its manufacturing system that was at risk. Now, this is a Swedish brand. It's kind of the high-end EV model of Volvo, but it's owned by a Chinese car maker. What did you make of this decision, and what lessons, if any, should Australia be learning from this experience?
Look, there's two reasons behind this decision. There's the legitimate data concerns, and I think those issues do apply to Australia, where people do have some concerns about how much information is flowing back and how much state control the Chinese government has over automotive makers based there. And as you say, Polestar is majority owned by the Geely Corporation, massive Chinese automotive company. So even though it's headquartered in Sweden, there were obviously questions about data sharing and transfer between that operation and its Chinese owners. Interestingly, of course, Volvo, which is the sister company, is still allowed to sell electric vehicles and regular internal combustion vehicles in the US and was granted an exception last month to be able to keep doing so under these new rules. So what data arrangements Volvo has compared to Polestar?
It does seem odd.
Well, Volvo's also, and this is the second factor which doesn't apply to Australia because we lost most of our automotive industry and we removed most of the tariffs, most of the protection, and with the high Australian dollar earlier this century, the auto industry here collapsed and now we've got nothing to protect. So As a lot of economists would say, from a free trader's perspective, Australia is a great case study in the benefits of not protecting local industries that might be uncompetitive, because Australians are benefiting from all these cars that can't be sent from China to the US, because you talk about Polestar being banned, but a whole bunch of other Chinese car makers, such as BYD being a prime example, have never been selling in the US because of these kind of restrictions.
And a huge tariff, 100% tariff.
Exactly, yep. And the tariffs. So, you know, it's uneconomic for them to sell in the US. They're selling to us instead. So Australia, Europe, other parts of the world are getting the benefit of China needing markets to offload its cars. So from that sense, you know, I guess an economically rational decision maybe for the US, if you believe in protectionism and protecting the US auto industry and what's left of it. But for a country like Australia, aside from the security concerns, it's a bit of a win, because Polestar's got to sell its cars somewhere, and we're a very wealthy market looking to buy EVs and high-end EVs.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting here is that you can kind of see competing goals at play. So on one hand, it's great to see Australians buying more electric vehicles. It means that that you're more likely to meet your climate goals. It means less cars being fueled by fossil fuels, particularly as we get the electricity grid being more and more reliant on renewable energy. It also means, from a national security perspective, you're less reliant on imported liquid fuels,
which
90%.
Which is a huge issue, of course, this year.
Exactly. But then you have this question about national security of data, and potentially that question about infrastructure, who controls the tech. And I think that the current government has decided to try to go softly, softly, quietly, quietly when it comes to interactions with China around technology questions. We did have the famous case of Huawei, the Chinese tech company, being banned from participating in Australia's telecommunications infrastructure for similar concerns about whether or not that was a national security risk for Australia to have that company involved with kind of the backbone of our telecommunications system, the national broadband network. And I think people at the moment, I'm sure in the back end, our government agencies are looking into how big a risk this is. And I know this was brought up when it came to the purchase, for example, of electric buses that we've seen recently, and about whether or not, you know, there could be kind of an offshore kill switch on these type of vehicles and how big a risk that was. How seriously do you think consumers should be thinking about this? And should we be hearing more from the government about whether or not they share similar concerns to the US and what is being done to mitigate them?
Yeah, I mean, look, I guess on the one end, there's things like data harvesting. And, you know, I think for your average consumer, look, to be honest, US multinationals data harvest all the time. European regulations are much tighter around that kind of thing and what their corporates can do. But, you know, you sign up to social media, you sign up to various apps on your phone, and you're already trading away a lot of this privacy and potentially open to being tracked. And some of our colleagues at the ABC over the years have done really good stories about just how much data your phone can reveal about you. Obviously, the concern here is this data potentially can be accessed by the Chinese government, and there might be more selective uses of this data. So for the average person, look, maybe the Chinese government doesn't care where Joe Bloggs is driving on the weekend, but if you're a powerful corporate leader, maybe doing something you shouldn't be or visiting someone you shouldn't, and the Chinese government can track that through your car and then come back and use that to extort you for confidential commercial information or other means, that would be the kind of areas where the Australian government might be getting concerned. And then obviously the more automated cars get and self-driving, there's obviously the concern too, as you say, about whether there's some kind of override function which could cause gridlock and chaos if you just cause a string of accidents by malfunctioning software. But I think by the time you get to that point, we're talking war scenarios.
And I think you are right to raise the comparison with American tech, because I think what we've also seen recently with, for example, Elon Musk's SpaceX company and Starlink is this one human being has the power to potentially cripple the infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure, for a specific country, depending on what he decides, whether or not he does or doesn't want Starlink to operate in that country. And this has been brought up as an issue because Starlink has become increasingly popular in Australia. It is directly competing with the national broadband network. Telecommunications companies are partnering with it. But again, that fundamental question of, well, who actually gets to decide whether or not it is operating in Australia? He upset the Iranian government by saying it could continue to operate there. There were questions about where it was operating in Ukraine, how far past the line of conflict it was being utilized. I mean, these are big questions, and Australia as a, well, we call ourselves a middle power, but I think when it comes to technology, we're a very small player. How reliant we can be on any country's tech and whether or not we do have the sovereign ability to control how our data is being collected and where it's actually going, I think that is a real question.
And who do you trust more, Xi Jinping or Elon Musk?
And I think for a long time, Australians were much more comfortable with American tech companies having a pretty essential role in our lives. You know, they're part of Five Eyes, longtime ally. We think of them as a pretty similar type of democracy. I think the last few years have probably changed some people's minds on how much you can trust American data retention.
Recent Lowy polling showing that trust in America as an ally has plummeted under the latest Trump administration. So yeah. I think you're raising a lot of valid points there. You know, people are not automatically assuming that the US and its companies are more trustworthy necessarily than the Chinese estate and companies which have, let's say, grey relationships with the party leadership in Beijing.
Yeah, and America has decided to go down the path of targeting China in particular through its legislation. I guess the question for Australia is a response to say, well, no particular car company, if we're sticking to EVs, is able to send that data overseas or that we have control over that, because there are different options. You know, you still have Japanese EVs, you've got Korean EVs, you've got European EVs, you've got American EVs, and of course Chinese EVs. The question is, do we need a set of rules around that? I think it's just going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. For many people, I don't think it's front of mind right now. At the moment, people are deciding, you know, how does this car compare to this other car on price? How does it compare on range? How does it fit into my lifestyle? But I think as people become more and more aware of what data is being collected and how it is being collected and what it potentially could be used for, I think people might get more concerned.
And as I said, I think it matters a lot more for people in sensitive lines of work, people who work for the security agencies, for high levels of government, high-level corporate leaders, people who could be extorted based on what data shows about their activities.
And we've heard the government is already suggesting to ministers in EVs to be careful about private conversations. You should not consider a vehicle which has microphones to be a safe space to be having confidential conversations. You know, we say in media, imagine that every microphone is live, every camera is on, and don't be having conversations where there are microphones. And that is, you know, it's a difficult thing to navigate because each of our smartphones is also equipped with all those functionalities. But you kind of do need to start thinking, well, I need to be well away from electronic devices if I'm having a proper confidential conversation.
Yeah, and when ads start popping up on your phone for things that you've just been talking about 5 minutes earlier, it does make you wonder just how much your phone's listening in.
Let's talk about trust and about government steps to try to ensure that the property market in particular is acting in accordance with our anti-money laundering and terrorism financing legislation. This is a big step. And Dan Ziffer has done a great article on the ABC website about this. So this is from the 1st of July. Finally, Michael, I feel like we've been talking about this for a
decade.
This Wednesday, we will see, finally, people involved in property transactions in Australia also have to adhere to the rules around anti-money laundering and reporting requirements. How big a step is this, and how will people experience the change?
So, Carrington, it's been about 20 years since the original anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws that apply to financial institutions were passed. So these laws have been about two decades in the making because it's always been intended that eventually real estate agents, conveyancers, accountants, and other people who deal with large sums of money in these sort of transactions would be covered by the counter-terrorism financing and anti-money laundering rules. Australia is way behind most of the rest of the world, particularly the advanced economies, in terms of implementing this. And so from Wednesday, from July 1 this year, real estate agents, conveyancers, other lawyers involved in setting up companies or involved in real estate transactions or other property-related transactions, gem dealers and other people who previously haven't been covered by this kind of legislation, which has long applied to things like banks and money lending, will now be covered and they will need to know their client. So basically, where is the money coming from to buy this property? Now, for your ordinary home buyer, it won't make too much of a difference because you've had to go out, prove your identity, go and get a mortgage. If you go to your real estate agent or your conveyancer and say, look, here's the bank that I'm paying for this property, here's the mortgage, easy peasy, just tick a box, no worries.
The money's come from my wages, it's pretty easy to see who I work for, etc.
Yeah, exactly. You've already done that with the bank because
yeah.
They'll have checked all of that. Where it comes in is there's some interesting data that PEXA, which is the private company that handles digital real estate transactions across a lot of Australia and the government property registries, they've been collecting data on cash purchases of property. And almost 30% of properties in 2023 were paid for in cash.
That's
they didn't involve a loan.
Wow.
It's extraordinary. It's not all money laundering. In fact, very little of it is. Most of it is people who've paid off their mortgage and are now downsizing or moving to a different property and don't need a mortgage because what they're selling for covers the purchase price of what they're buying. But there is a portion within that that would be dubious transactions. And because it hasn't been covered by these regulations, real estate has been a bit of a honeypot for illicit money because there weren't questions being asked about how you bought this, you know, $5 million North Shore house or, you know, in Sydney or where the cash came from to buy this, you know, off the plan development for $1.5 million here. This is a huge, you know, if you want to launder money in large sums, real estate is the place to do it.
And can we take a step back though, Michael? I think people hear anti-money laundering, and to a lot of people, it's still a kind of confusing concept. Why do people want to put money into property? What is the purpose of laundering it by putting it into an asset?
Yeah, so basically, government authorities, one of the ways they can track criminal and terrorism activity is following the cash flows, right? So you need, if you're raising cash from illicit means, you need a way of being able to move that cash and then ideally to filter it so that it looks like it's come from a legitimate source. That's why casinos have also, until recently, been a honeypot for money laundering because high rollers would come with tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in illicit cash.
Yeah.
You gamble it at the casino, you might lose some of it, but what you walk out with, you say, oh, I won it at the casino.
Yeah.
And so you've cleaned that cash so that it looks like it might have come from a legitimate source, and it makes it much harder for those agencies and the federal police and so forth to go back and find where the money really came from. And the same thing has been happening in real estate. AUSTRAC back in 2020 estimated that around $1 billion of investment in real estate had come from Chinese criminal gangs alone.
Yeah.
And that's not including all of the other domestic and foreign sources of illicit money. So AUSTRAC has long wanted these laws to be implemented so that it can have visibility about where the cash for real estate purchases is going. Because once the property's purchased, it's much harder for them to track down. And it could be purchased using a shell company. So shell companies now are being caught up in these new rules. If you're a lawyer that helps businesses set up these, you know, corporate entities that might own assets in their name, you need to find out who's behind those companies, the real individuals. And that just helps these law enforcement agencies maintain a track of the flow of cash. And so that ultimately they can go to someone and say, well, you've got a $10 million harbourfront property. Where did the money come from?
And I think one of the concerns that has been raised is offshore money, and particularly getting around places that have capital controls like China, and that this is a way of spiriting money out from China, getting around Chinese rules but also Australian rules, and then depositing the money in property, and then, you know, 10 years later you can sell it, or whatever time period, and then the money looks clean at that point. So the question becomes, this is happening on the 1st of July. As you said, it's been a long time coming, but the time it is coming is when the Australian property market appears to be in some of it's suffering from some of its greatest pressure that we've seen in recent years. And by pressure, I mean downward price pressure. The latest Cotality data out, yes, the auction clearance preliminary auction clearance rate was slightly above what it was last week, but it's still below 50%, even at the preliminary rate. We're expecting it to be in the early 40s by the time we get the final numbers. We know that real estate agents, people watching the property, are suggesting we've already seen price cuts in Sydney and Melbourne in particular, and most economists now believe that we're going to see further falls this year and into next year because of not only the changes to taxation around property, negative gearing, capital gains tax discount, but also because we've seen three interest rate hikes. Maybe there's more to come, maybe there's not, but that has really changed the market. And I think we've already seen a lot of the speculative money go out of property. People no longer consider it to be a one-way bet this year. And now you have this change. Do you think this would have a meaningful impact on the property market, particularly because it's coming when it's coming?
It's hard to say because the nature of these funds, and up till now without the regulation about reporting, we just don't know how much dirty money exactly has been going into Australian real estate.
Yeah.
And so we had that estimate from AUSTRAC about $1 billion from criminal gangs linked with China, but we don't know how much is associated with domestic criminal gangs. For instance, we've seen the boom in illicit tobacco sales. How much of that money is being funneled through real estate to try and clean it so that it can be used for other things later on, or just as an investment in a relatively low regulation area where traditionally you could park this illicit cash without raising the attention of the Australian Taxation Office and through them the Australian Federal Police and other law enforcement agencies. So I don't think it's going to have a massive impact. I mean, I think on the scale of hierarchy, interest rate rises have been at the top because they were what turned the market. Then you've seen pretty major property tax changes, the biggest in at biggest tax changes in Australia in at least a quarter of a century. I think we can safely say that's had an impact on the market, particularly for investors. But now you've got this third factor, and it might have an impact at the premium end of the market, you know, where you're talking about high-end laundering for personal use. But you'd possibly be surprised that, you know, one of the highest area of cash transactions in terms of a percentage of sales was Marsden Park in outer suburban Sydney,
right,
which is an area with a lot of new developments. Now, is that an area where people are downsizing to with cash? I'm not sure. So how much, you know, are we seeing cash flowing through property investment as a means to park money that you don't really want the feds and the ATO to know about?
Why did it take so long for property players, people involved in property transactions, to be brought into these rules? I mean, it seems to be a no-brainer that you would want to be kind of trying to keep track of this, given how much money flows into property in Australia.
Yeah, it's a $12 trillion market,
yes,
in value.
It's been well identified for a long time. I think for a long time it was kind of property and like high-end art. So maybe we're going to see a massive inflation of art as people move their money around. But why did it take so long?
Look, a couple of reasons. There is, I mean, first and foremost, there's been an intense lobbying campaign against this, unsurprisingly, particularly from the real estate sector.
And is that because they just didn't want to do the extra paperwork, or they were worried that this would lead to lower transactions?
No, it is mainly the paperwork, I think, legitimately. I mean, there might be some particular agencies that are worried about transaction volumes and particular, you know, advisors who work with that end of clientele, but I think overall the property industry is just worried. This is an immense amount of paperwork that they haven't been doing before. And this is raising one of the issues that Dan looks at in his story, which is how many of these businesses are relatively unprepared for what's about to hit them. They've got 1 month of grace. So even though the laws take effect from July 1, they've got until 29th of July this year to get their reporting up and running, but that's not much time. And the potential fines if you don't comply are massive. We're talking for a corporation, per breach, a maximum fine of more than $36 million. And for an individual, a person, a maximum fine per breach of more than $7 million. Now, people don't usually get the maximum fines.
AUSTRAC does have a reputation for putting some pretty massive fines.
I was just going to say, the two biggest corporate fines in Australian history are, first up was the Commonwealth Bank with a $700 million penalty for its so-called intelligent, its smart ATMs, which violated a lot of the money laundering monitoring rules. And then Westpac got hit with an even bigger $1.3 billion fine over its failure on thousands of occasions to report suspicious transactions. So, you know, this is a big deal for anyone who works in professional services. Yeah. They have a track record. They take it seriously. People have a month to get their act together and do this reporting. I know people who work in the law and have been struggling to get around this and trying to put things into place. I mean, there's also, you know, it is slightly unfair too, where like Dan's talked to Ray White Group, which obviously is a big corporate real estate agency group, and they've provided a lot of support for the agents under them to set up these processes. If you're an independent agency with, you know, 2-3 people, it's a lot of work to just get this established, but people have to do it, because if they don't do it by the 29th of July, AUSTRAC will come knocking on their door.
Yeah, do not mess with AUSTRAC. That really is my number one piece of advice. That is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. If you've missed today's episode of Fuelcast, you can catch it in the feed. It's right before this one. And keep your eyes and ears peeled for the first episode of our Tax Time bonus series, scheduled to hit your feeds bright and early tomorrow morning. So you don't miss out, make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Michael.
Thanks, Carrington.